All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Sex Sells Podcast, the podcast where we talk about culture, dating, relationships, and society from a male and female perspective. Today, we are covering a topic that we said we were going to cover in a future podcast a couple of podcasts ago, and that is professional relationships, but specifically manipulative professional relationships. And we're going to draw on some of the parallels that you'd have in a romantic relationship as to what you would experience in a professional relationship, and whether things like manipulation, narcissism, all those buzzwords that are very common in the internet now can still be applied to professional relationships. We're also going to talk about radical honesty, and that is loosely related to professional relationships. Do you be as honest as you possibly can, or do you sugarcoat it? And we're going to get into that at the 3-minute mark. Before we do, we're sponsored by Crush Organics. Do you want to relax? Do you want to chill out? Do you want to let go of some of that anxiety? Get yourself some Crush Organic CBD oil. Crush with a K, crushorganics.com. Use the code Neil, N-E-E-L. It's pretty shocking how many people are big fans of mine and still don't know how to spell my name properly. So N-E-E-L, I know it's a weird spelling, but it's actually a very logical spelling. N-E-I-L is the illogical spelling. Neil doesn't make sense. So anyway, use the code Neil. Get yourself 40% off the huge range of Crush Organic CBD oils and gummies. Love those gummies. Have them every night. Come to a comedy show, comedyuntamed.com. We got shows in Sydney, shows in Melbourne, shows in Geelong, shows in Newcastle. So it's always very nice when after the show, people come up to me and say they're big fans of the Sex Sells podcast. So come along to a comedy show. It's pretty funny how many people also come expecting you to be there, Eliza.
Aww.
And sort of think, look, she just had a baby. Do you think she's going to fly to Geelong and do a random comedy show?
I will.
And a lot of people who come to the comedy shows who are fans of this podcast then try to put in it. They think that the comedy show is going to be related, sort of talking about relationships and things. Look, it's not like we avoid that, but it's a comedy show. It's very different to the podcast. It's not like the podcast, but it's just as good. So come along to Comedy Untamed, comedyuntamed.com. We're no longer offering subscriptions. Neil and Jordan, my other podcast, is on indefinite hiatus, but we raised $11,140. So everyone who has been a subscriber, thank you so much. We're going to think about doing some new ones for Sex Sells, and I will keep everyone updated. If you're still being charged for that subscription, send an email to neil.business@outlook.com. Okay, radical honesty, let's go. Okay, this was your topic suggestion. The radical honesty part was, what made you want to talk about this? Be as radically honest as you can.
I saw a video that was made, but I think she's a psychotherapist. At the very least, she's a coach of some kind. I'm pretty sure she's both. But I saw a video and I had mixed feelings of it, and she was basically reenacting a discussion about why radical honesty is so essential and so important and so freeing, liberating, blah, blah, blah. And basically in the conversation that she was reenacting, she was playing two different people going back and forth. And as one person, she was saying, or he was saying, I've noticed you've gained a lot of weight. I'm going to be really honest and tell you what I've noticed. And then she responds saying, okay, are you telling me that because you're interested in you're concerned for my well-being, or are you telling me that in a sense that you've lost attraction to me? And then he responds saying, I've lost attraction to you. And so initially when hearing that, you kind of like, is that one thing that you genuinely want to hear? Is that what you want to be told up front? I no longer find you attractive. Like, I imagined, I obviously gained so much weight during my pregnancy. My body was definitely not attractive after I gave birth. And if Adrian had ever told me, I don't find this attractive at the moment, I'd be shattered. Like, I even said to him, lie to me for as long as you can. Tell me I'm the most beautiful thing. Like, do not ever mention, not that he ever would, but I was very, very upfront. But anyway, then she continues the scenario.
Can I jump in really quickly? Maybe I should have said this at the start, but I'm sure you can tell from the phrase radical honesty, but I've just got a nice little description of it here. Radical honesty is a philosophy that advocates for complete transparency and authenticity in communication, even if it means being brutally honest and potentially hurting others' feelings. Okay, go on. Sorry.
Should have mentioned that, but yeah. And anyway, so he says that, yeah, actually my attraction is wavering. But then she says, well, this is actually a benefit that you're so radically honest, because now I know that you aren't seeing me for my intelligence, my empathy. You aren't attracted to that. You're attracted to my looks, and I'm aging and blah, blah, blah. And they're going to change over the years. So now I get to make a decision on our relationship based on this. So anyway, that's a summarized version of it. But I was in two camps about this. Like, is this something that is actually, as there is, like you said, like a philosophy about it, and there's a community of people. I've seen a lot of therapists, not a lot. I've seen some therapists, I should say, and even coaches specifically working to be radically honest and teaching people how to do that and having, you know, a lot of thought camps about why it's essential. But then other people say actually radical honesty can really contradict empathy. And what's more important in a relationship or in a professional or romantic, it can be offensive, it can be brutal, it can be unnecessary to share every single thought. But then some therapists, I heard one therapist, and he said that when people are, you know, being people-pleasing or withholding in their relationships or avoiding conflict and not just saying exactly how they feel in any moment at any given time, that they will forever be repeating the same relationship cycles and they'll be forever stuck in the same trauma loops that they may have. And he did make a good example of if you are thinking something along the lines of, you know, oh, he's not into me because he hasn't kissed me in 2 hours or something. What are you actually doing to fact check that? Like, how are you giving yourself a reality check? Because you could just say, I feel anxious and I want to know, are you still into me? Whereas in most, you know, 99% of people may not express our innermost thoughts, anxieties and fears. And by doing so, we continue ourselves in a loop ongoing of having those. So that's kind of one of the reasons why it's seen as such a positive thing. So one, heal trauma, benefit your relationships, and also for self-discovery, because a lot of it is like, it's almost goes hand in hand with mindfulness. Like the first thing they say is, you know, notice how your body feels. Are you elated? Are you angry? Then notice your surroundings and then say exactly what it is that you feel. And you'd be surprising not only to other people, but to yourself. But then again, if there's two people in the scenario, if you're being radically honest to someone, and do you want someone to constantly be radically honest to you and say, actually, I don't think you look good in that, or, you know, I don't think this is right. And I have dated someone once who was, I would say, radically honest, and I thought he was abusive because, God, all he did was note every single flaw he thought I had and then would put it in a nice pretty bow by saying, I'm just being really honest. And I'm like, God, do you have anything fucking nice to say? No, he didn't. So, yeah, I feel a little – I'm in two camps about it, but
– yeah, me too. I usually sugarcoat truths in my professional life and personal life, but it doesn't mean I don't say the truth. I just try to say it in a way. I think that what's the phrase? A harsh truth is different to the truth delivered harshly. And harsh truths are sometimes important, but you can deliver a harsh truth in an empathetic way.
Yeah.
Whereas the truth delivered harshly can just make people hate you. And as long as these people who are radically honest then don't, because I know people like that who will say, well, oh, I'll just tell it like it is. I'll just say what's on my mind. If you don't like all these people on Facebook, isn't that their cover photo? If you don't like me, piss off. Well, and then as soon as you say something to them that's not even radically honest, slightly honest, they can't handle it. So if you're going to be radically honest, at least if you're going to dish it out, you got to be able to cop it. So that's the first thing I would say on a policy of radical honesty. But relating this to a professional opinion, everyone has dealt with bosses and managers that are savage and brutal and dictatorial. But then if you've been on the other side of the coin, if you've been a boss or been in charge of people, or been a manager of some sort, you've dealt with employees that are lazy and don't listen and always have narrative that they are being manipulated and they are being taken advantage of. And it's professional relationships, much like any other relationship, seem to always bring about a victim mindset in many ways. Just the other day, I was talking to someone who manages a theater, and she was venting to me about how she had to fire two people, and then they've gone and told all the staff that she's manipulative and that she was being too strict and too harsh and being basically an abusive employer. Now, I haven't heard their side of the story. I just heard her side of the story. And I guess coming back to radical honesty, if you're a boss, I know you've managed people in your professional life.
Mm.
And we did do a podcast on this last year. I'm managing people right now as well, and you almost can't be radically honest with creative people. I read a book, How to Manage Creative People, and this was the best book I've ever read. This was so eye-opening, and you essentially, in a weird way, it was suggesting to massage creative people's ego and offer them the space to be able to fulfill their vision, and they're not the sort of executing, systematizing types who need to be told, this is what needs to be done, this is how you do it, you're not doing it. You can't be that direct and blunt with creative people. So you kind of have to massage them and maybe talk broadly about how they are finding the situation and whether there's a way to encourage more enthusiasm from them. And now, look, obviously there's a point. If they're just completely not doing something, you got to tell them that, and you got to pull them in line. But I guess this book was more about how to get the best out of creative people, and it probably didn't talk about radical honesty per se, but it definitely hinted at the fact that radical honesty is definitely not the best policy for a creative person in a creative field. Now, that's a small sliver of one part of the workforce. I'm sure in other industries, radical honesty would be the best policy. I know from what I've heard, at least on the job side or generally in male-dominated industries, they are very radically honest. Mm. They are quite brutally honest, and some people appreciate that. They just want to be told how it is, and they don't want this sort of namby-pamby, tiptoeing around the truth, sugarcoating it. They just want to be told, hey, look, you're not living up to this standard. You're not working to this standard. You need to be better. Pull your head in, or whatever it might be. Whereas for other people, they can get turned off by that. And actually, Esther Perel made a really great point on her Instagram a couple of weeks ago, talking about how we're seeing professional relationships and romantic relationships in different ways, where some people now are talking about things like rate of interest and these sort of corporate terms in their romantic relationship, and what's in it for me, and how can I get the best out of this? Whereas in a not necessarily a corporate, but a professional workspace, we are talking about empathy and emotional intelligence, and definitely in white-collar jobs. I don't know specifically what it would be like in more blue-collar environments, but even then, from my very limited understanding of how those industries have evolved over the last couple of years, there is more of that now.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting how we're almost expecting a social community in a professional environment when what's best for business is for people to be as productive and borderline robotic as possible. Now, that's obviously not possible because we're dealing with humans here until ChatGPT takes over. But it was a very interesting juxtaposition that she made. How now our romantic relationships are becoming more arguably logical or even
transactional.
Yeah, transactional, using corporate language in our professional relationships tend to be becoming more social and empathetic. And I have no doubt this is a byproduct of many more women moving into the workforce and moving into positions of power within the workforce. And my guess would be that men tend to be more radically honest. But I've met women who are very radically honest and men who are not. You know, this is obviously a stereotype. Do you think do you think radical honesty can get to a point where it is abusive, or it is maybe not abusive is a strong word, it is mean-spirited and actually just suboptimal in a professional environment where you don't actually get the best out of someone if you're just succinctly and brutally telling them exactly what they're doing wrong and not encouraging them in any way? What do you think?
Yeah, I've been on both sides of the coin with this. Well, first of all, as an external example, and yeah, I'm going to go there. I'm going to bring up maths, but you know, Shannon, are you watching it?
Yeah, but I'm quite a few episodes behind.
Okay, well, it's not too much of a spoiler.
I know what you're going to. That guy's he's what I was saying, he's radically honest, but then he can't cop it.
Yeah, but also I feel like he uses the excuse of being radically honest to hide behind his abuse. He is abusive, like basically manipulating his poor wife. Or, I mean, obviously it was produced and edited, so who knows? But he would say things like, you know, if someone more attractive had walked down the aisle rather than you, I wouldn't be lusting after my ex-wife and wanting to leave the experiment. And then he says, I'm just being really honest. I'm an honest person. But really, that's actually quite hurtful and really mean. And there's consistent elements and a pattern of him belittling his partner and then using the mask as, I'm just really honest. This is, I'm just really upfront with how I feel. And I feel like this is a thing, especially with men, that say they're really honest. It's just a way to soften the fact that they don't have empathy towards your feelings and they're going to say what they feel at times. And, of course, women do this too. But like you said, I do think it is more common, especially in the workplace with men, because it would be considered more respected by men to do that, and it may not be viewed the same way for a woman to do it. And to be fair, I had a boss who is radically honest and I didn't like it. I did not like it one bit. And no one did, actually. But in terms of my personal experience being on two sides of the coin, I guess on both sides on how to approach my team with it, I might have spoken about this before, but I did a leadership program recently last year, and it went for a few months where they basically bring in leaders within this industry, and you learn about your leadership style and who you are and how you can develop, etc., blah, 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 blah. And one of the things that I kind of reflected on is, say, in my job, every single month I had to get a report. I needed my employees to write a report to me. And then from all their reports, I would create my own report. And then my report would go up to the CEO, whoever would analyze it. Then it goes up to the board. And this report was really essential. It was like, had any children moved? What had happened? What sessions had occurred? All developmental changes, everything. And so I would send out reminders constantly being like, it's in your calendars. I put a week in advance. Hi, guys, don't forget Friday. I need this done in, this report sent in to me so I can send mine off on Monday, blah, blah, blah. And they would never, ever, ever come in on time. Ever. And I was so perplexed to what to do. I'd go up to them in person and ask them. I would send an email reminding them. I would literally put it in their calendar, block out time to get them to do it, and they wouldn't do it. And it was a tedious task. It's pages and pages. And then eventually it got so frustrating because I would get a lot of, you know, I couldn't send my report off, and then I was looking like an disorganized person myself because everyone else was able to send their reports in but me, because my team had it sent them to me. And what I was doing to my team is, you know, I know that my team really liked me as a person. We got along really well. We had socialized. They would open up to me a lot. There was always kind of like a safe space to talk in. They always commented on how much they liked me, and I'm like their favorite team leader they've ever had, blah, blah, blah. And so when this became an issue, I would write an email to my team, and I was basically trying to appeal to their empathy and say, hey guys, like when you're not sending in these reports, which has happened, you know, in October, November, December now on time, it reflects poorly on me. Management gets called into question as well, and my capacity to get these reports. If you have any other feedback on how I can, you know, help and support you to write these reports, please let me know. But it's really, really important for me and for the kids and for everyone that these reports get sent in on time. Please let me know if there are any barriers to completing this. Anyway, I was trying to make them feel bad, basically, and make them feel sorry for me that I was cutting the slack for them and always taking the fall for them. And it still didn't work. And after months of it, and then I did this leadership program, basically I ended up saying, if your report's not in, you're getting called into a meeting and there's consequences. Basically, you get a warning. And then everyone kind of started it quick, smart. And but I hated having to go down that approach and being like, this doesn't happen, then here's a consequence. Because what happens once I start taking that approach, or once from my experience of my leaders or other leaders, when they start taking that approach wholly with their team, is that when your team loses respect for you or stops liking you or isn't invested in you, especially in my industry where emotional investment is really key, then the work is even poorer. And I found that the best way I can get my team to do really good work is motivating them and having them have a personal investment, being like, having this done is strongly correlated to our outcomes being completed faster for these children and families, like wanting them to be really invested in it. So there'd be two approaches that I had to take. And I wouldn't say one is better than the other. It's interesting hearing you talk about that creative book, because when you talked about how to work with creatives, I consider myself a creative person, and I feel like I was naturally taking that approach, and maybe I should have been taking less of that approach, like doing the opposite within my field and industry, like less of the massaging of the egos, being like, I know you guys are working so hard, this job isn't easy, but let's try to do this. And I should have just been like, cut the shit, send it to me.
Yeah. And so maybe massaging the ego is not the appropriate term to use there. It's not always sort of thinking about external factors, but just taking a different approach to changing the way they perceive what they're doing can often be a very effective way in getting the best out of a creative person. Mm-hmm. So if they feel like it's becoming job-like, if it's becoming too formulaic and corporate, they're going to detach and they're going to quiet quit. And so you need to arguably, some would say manipulate their narrative into thinking, which a good organization should be for them anyway, into sort of understanding that they're part of something bigger. And from what I've heard, that's the brilliance of Elon Musk. He gets all these people on board with a vision. And any good CEO gets them on board with a vision, and in many ways brings the best out of people without simply just telling them, oh, this is what you have to do and this is why you do it. They say, this is the company vision, this is the mission of our organization, and you might even be working long hours and getting less pay, but this is why you want to be a part of it, and this is what it can do for you. And the thing with manipulation, I guess, is that good manipulation is in many ways, you don't even realize it. So that person on maps was clearly not a good manipulator, which is a scary thought, right? Because you think, oh, well, then what is the manipulation I've been unaware of? Now, the word manipulation, we've done podcasts on this. Who knows what that really even means? Is it a sort of lopsided, unfair relationship? I mean, almost every relationship, whether it's professional or romantic, both parties have to think that they're getting a better end of the bargain in some way, shape or form, which sounds very corporate and doesn't exactly sound romantic. But if you don't feel like you're getting at least an equal deal or a better deal out of some sort of relationship, then you're not going to want to be in it. And so a good leader isn't just yelling at people, telling them what to do. He or she brings the best out of those people. Having said that, I've also heard stories about an NRL team, the Melbourne Storm, who are unbelievably successful, and they have been for the better part of two decades. And the coach who essentially runs the organization there is known as quite a hard taskmaster, and he is a disciplinarian, and he is strict, and he runs it like a military camp. And at the end of each game, the players will just sit there in a circle and be radically honest to each other and say, you didn't do this, you could have done this better, you could do that. Now, this is probably the most masculine workplace you could get, a professional rugby league team. And I wonder if that would be as effective a strategy in a gender diverse corporate environment. I would doubt it. And I mm-hmm. think a good manager can actually mold their management style within reason to the sort of team that they're surrounded by.
Yeah.
Having said that, we're two people who are more on the employer / manager side of things, and it's probably a lot of people listening thinking, yeah, my boss is still an asshole. So
yeah,
it's pretty hard to define when a professional relationship gets manipulative or gets lopsided. There's laws about that in Australia. There's rules, minimum wage laws and things like that. And then there's all these statistics here that say 87% of people do not feel engaged at work. I think this is in America.
Wow.
58% of employees have experienced workplace bullying. And then, you know, bullying, what is it? At what point does it become bullying, right? Because if you're being radically honest and you got a big client and you got to get this deal done for the sake of the company, and you're saying, come on, just fucking do it, like get this done. Now, that could come across as bullying, which in most situations probably is, but, you know, is that the person's character? Is that the permanent state of a work environment? Or is it that a business by its nature has to aim towards certain goals and it sometimes has to sacrifice the emotional well-being of the employees? Within reason, because it can't be a slave-like situation, obviously. But there are times when, for the sake of the organization, and because we live in a competitive marketplace, you have to push people and you have to push yourself. And it can be easily construed as manipulative, but it's very subjective, because everyone will tell you they've got an asshole boss, but then every boss will tell you, I've got asshole employees. So who the hell is correct in this situation?
Nice. I mean,
this kind of came about when we were talking about porn, wasn't it? So there were young women who were being, some would say, groomed into doing pornography. Mm. And then my question was, okay, at what age do they have full volition over their professional choices? So if they're 18 and the person getting them into porn is in their late 20s or early 30s and is also maybe, yeah, richer or has a position of power, people would say that might be manipulative. But then what if the woman is 22? What if she's 25? At what point does it stop being manipulative and it starts being a bad choice from the person who agreed to a certain contract? Similarly, there's also circumstantial issues where people have no choice but to do a certain job. But then, I mean, at what point does it become a manipulative relationship then if you had no choice but you still did it? Well, if you agreed to certain terms and that's how it ended up, well, what are you supposed to do in that sort of a situation? And I know this is probably a bit awkward. Maybe we should have done radical honesty first and then manipulative professional relationships. But just coming back to radical honesty one more time, it's different for different people in the sense that maybe there's a woman out there for that guy from maths who would actually appreciate that. I know I don't like it when people are too, and this is more in a professional environment, I don't like it when people are just trying to be too nice about what they're about to say. I'd rather someone just be direct and say it. I know in previous romantic relationships, I've had one particular ex-girlfriend who was very direct and abrasive and hurtful, but it allowed me to reflect on things better than in other situations where, say, in the last podcast when you were talking about friend zoning, where some people would sort of massage the truth and say, you're a really nice guy. I'd actually prefer in that situation. It would be hurtful, but I know from my experience, I'd rather someone just say it, just say, hey, you were too short, or you weren't funny enough, or you said this thing I didn't like, or something like that. So I do like radical honesty, but I also like it when it comes with, you know, just a human element. It shouldn't just be a sort of robotic slave-like thing. But anyway.
I think you can be, you know, very honest and empathetic. I would consider myself a really honest person, and I, you know, will display that with a lot of empathy and gentleness. But also I know that I'm a very direct person as well. But I guess the point of radical honesty is it is a community as well as a philosophy, and they don't pick and choose when they're going to be radically honest. It's something that you have to truly and wholly live by consistently in order for it to work, because part of it, like I said before, is being honest with your internal dialogue as well. Which, you know, we even said this in our last podcast when we were saying, if you've been friend zoned over and over and over again, and you keep telling yourself, I'm going to get friend zoned. Yes, law of attraction, you know, self-fulfilling prophecy. You probably will get friend zoned again. You're subconsciously going to pick someone that's going to friend zone you again. So start telling yourself, I'm worthy. I won't be getting friend zoned. But then that contradicts wholly with radical honesty, because you are getting friend zoned constantly. So there's just all these elements there that make it like, what is it, right? Is it wrong? Is it better for you? Is it freeing? Is it not? I don't know. But then I think another point as well is, imagine if someone is, if you're, you know, really into this radical honesty thing, as people are, and Neil, you're telling me something in this podcast, and I'm like, I'm not interested in hearing this. I'm bored of this. Like, I don't like what you're saying. It'd just be so abrupt, probably rude. And I'm curious how radical honesty correlates with improving relationships, like a lot of therapists claim that it does. I can see how it might benefit in emotionally intimate or romantic relationships where you really trust that person and there's so much love there as a foundation already that you can say, like, this is how I'm feeling. But there were other parts of it that made me cringe a little bit, where I'm like, I don't know actually how I feel about it. Let me know what your thoughts are on this. So as well as just being upfront about your, you know, your views, your opinions and how you feel, a lot of it is about being upfront about your subconscious processing as well. So say, for example, you and I are having a debate and I'm a radical honest person. I might say, like, I'm really determined to prove myself right. So I'm going to continue debating until I feel like I've proved myself right. And that is an example of radical honesty, which in some points I'm like, okay, that's good, because that actually happened the other day when my friends, there's three of us, we were in a group chat and we were having a debate about something. We were actually having a debate about the mental health crisis with young people. And one of my friends was saying, you know, it's really it's because of TikTok. It's because kids self-diagnose and they are oversaturating the healthcare system. And my other friend was saying it's because of social media. Like, yes, that's right, but it's because of social media that we can learn about these things. There's also, you know, the way that women and AFAB people get neglected in healthcare systems. We know that. So having been misdiagnosed or not diagnosed, there's a lot of studies that say women will get, on average, given a diagnosis of the same symptoms as men 4 years later, or 4 years older than they were, all these things. Anyway, long story short, my friends were disagreeing with each other. It was getting like, you couldn't tell the tone. It was getting maybe heated. And then my friend said, by the way, I'm in a super like ADHD, she has a diagnosed ADHD, and she said, I'm in serious ADHD mode and I'm really tuned into this conversation. Like, I'm really excited by it and passionate about it. And had she not said that, my other friend was interpreting it as being attacked because this other girl was sending message after message after message after message with essays about it. But she was like, I'm just really excited. So I thought in some ways, actually, this is good to say. She's giving us an insight to her, you know, her inner thoughts and her brain being like, this is me tuning in, like going full ADHD mode, hyper-focused, and letting us know that. And in that way, it was actually really beneficial and it was helpful. But can it be steering the conversation elsewhere if you and I were having a debate and you told me, like, by the way, I'm determined to prove myself right regardless of what you say? That might start a whole nother debate where I'm like, you're an asshole. So it's, I don't know. I, it doesn't necessarily sit right where I'm like, this is a really healthy thing to do. So I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it just seems like a identity that might be necessary in a world where we have probably sugarcoated a lot of things young people and for society. So I think something like this was probably bound to happen. And I think in other cultures, they are far more radically honest than the West right now. Especially somewhere like Eastern Europe, they'll just tell you what they think and they won't filter it. Western culture is generally quite polite and likes to tiptoe around the truth and not offend people. And so I think it's just contextual. I don't see how adopting it as a philosophy in a therapeutic sense, when, you know, I'm not a therapist, obviously, but maybe if there's some studies that show that it's beneficial, maybe if there's someone who's never really been, never really had a radically honest person in their life, then it might do them some short-term harm, but long-term good to hear some hard truths about themselves and their condition. So to me, it just seems like it would be very contextual. And I suppose what you get on social media is closer to radical honesty because there's no face-to-face interaction. And I've definitely received messages and comments that have pissed me off, to put it lightly. And then a couple of days later, I've thought, they had a point. And that's why I got really angry. But then there's also been situations where I've thought, nah, that guy was just trying to get under my skin. So I think if I had to choose between the two, I don't think it doesn't seem like a zero-sum game, but radical honesty is probably better than always sugarcoating everything. But it really depends on the situation. It depends on the person. It depends on so many factors. And actually, in a professional context, you have to be honest. If you're not, whether you want to be radically honest, but you have to be honest to a certain degree. You can't look, if you're a parent and maybe a child is not performing that well, then there's something to be said about maintaining a parent-child relationship there and still having a strong social bond. But if you're an employer and an employee is not doing what they're supposed to do, well, you can't sugarcoat that. You got to say, hey, you're not, you know, pick it up. I mean, there's a way to say it for certain people, but it seems to me that honesty is generally the best policy. But what you were talking about previously is different, and it takes a bit of experience and knowledge to know about things like, you know, placebo and self-fulfilling prophecies, where if you, you know, arguably lie to yourself about certain things, certain subjective characteristics that can be molded, that can then become those affirmations can then sort of manifest into actuality. And so something like in a business, if someone has a very strong vision and they're just so committed to it, well, that tunnel vision can actually create the conditions for that vision to manifest. Whereas if someone's unsure about their vision and thinks, yeah, if it works, it'll work, it might become a successful business, it might not, that doesn't seem like a particularly, even if it's more realistic and closer to the honest likely outcome, it doesn't seem like the best strategy to get the best out of the organization and the business. So coming back to professional relationships now. Sorry, by the way, to the listeners, yeah, I think I should have done these half an hour on one and half an hour on the other, but hopefully you still enjoy the podcast. How would you define a manipulative professional relationship?
I think a big one would be that they use like guilt or gaslighting as a way to motivate you. So saying, you know, if this doesn't get done, that ad doesn't go out, then we don't get paid. Or if you can't stay back and do this, I'll have to do it, but, you know, I'll have to call my husband to pick up the kids, like those kind of things to get you to stay back and work longer. I think that's manipulative. Another really big one is pointing out problems but not offering a solution. And I had a previous boss that did this, and she this is a radical honest boss as well that I was talking about before. She does this all the time, where she would tell me, like, Eliza, I need you to do something. And she'd give me this very vague task. Like, I want you to create an analysis report on whether or not we should spend money on having people transport kids to school so they go to school. And I'd be like, can I get some more specifics? Like, do you want graphs? Do you want me to find quotes? And she'd be like, just give it a go. So then I wrote a 40-page report, spent all weekend doing it. And she's like, oh, this isn't what I meant. And I was like, and she was like, try again. So I was like, okay, I've got 250 emails I have to reply to, literally, and so much work. I've got a team to manage. Can you tell me specifically what it is that you are looking for? And she was like, great work, but this isn't what I need. And she said, oh, I just need, make it more condensed and, you know, just reach out to some organizations. So then I'm going out to having meetings with organizations, condensing my work, spending hours and hours and doing it. And then she's like, no, that's not what I meant. And at that point I was like so mad. And this would happen constantly, like five times a week. She would get me to do something, write a report, create an analysis, do anything and never give me the details of it and then tell me it was wrong. And I had to sit her down one day and I said, if you don't give me the specifics to what you want, I'm going to send you one copy and that's it. I'm not doing anything more. Like, that's it. That's me stepping out. And then she was like, Eliza, if you're not willing to try and, you know, put yourself and do this type of, you know, development and try these different areas, then we have an issue here. And that to me was manipulative because I was like, well, I've spent 12 hours this week trying to do a task that I wasted all my time doing. So I think things like that can be a little bit manipulative when they're not offering specific solutions, but they're just saying this is wrong. This is not done correctly. It's wrong. And then I think another one, this might be a bit like controversial, but when you get a bad feeling about communicating with your superior or your leader or manager or whatever, or you find communicating with them really difficult, that might be a reflection on them compared to, say, other managers you've had, not just you as a personality trait, fearing authority or something. That could be one. And also getting not enough information or having vital information withheld from you can be a manipulation tactic. Like, or here's another one that my previous boss would do is I would come with a concern, and this is obviously like in my field, it would be a child protection concern, so quite serious, or concern for a family or something. And we had to work within, you know, the system. So we would make a negotiation and there would be no win-win solution. So that would be, and then I would also have to do that all the time with my team where they'd be like, you know, this kid, for example, has disabilities and autism and a lot of sensory issues. I want to buy this play equipment. This is a real example. I want to buy this play equipment. It's $3,000. It has like a sensory pod and this and that. And I would be like, we don't have the funds for that. But then my employer would be like, but you have the funds to pay $3,000 for her braces. So you do have the funds. And I'd be like, we can't delegate this to equipment. We can put forward $950 because here's a cheaper alternative. Just those things where it's like they were viewing me as maybe perhaps being manipulative or unfair, whereas I was like, well, I'm working within a whole other side of funds and financials that you don't even know about. So a lot of those things can be nuanced or even subjective, but I definitely think the first ones of, like, you know, using guilt to motivate you or putting you down, belittling you, like I'm always building my team up and really focusing on their positive, being like, here's an area for development, but these are also your strengths. Whereas some bosses I know will never ever mention anything you've ever done. You might put in hours and hours and hours of work that never get acknowledged, but the one time something is slightly lacking, it gets pulled up massively. I find that to be a bit of professional manipulation, in my opinion.
Sounds like an Indian parent. So how much of this is to play devil's advocate? Yeah. How much of it, to play devil's advocate as a boomer, how much of this is millennials and Gen Z expecting way too much from a workplace and wanting to always feel comfortable and always manipulating the narrative themselves to make themselves to be the victim when, as you know, there are certain goals and targets that an organization or company has to reach. And part of the implicit understanding for everyone in that organization is that you have to do what's reasonably possible to meet those targets and goals. And obviously knowing how some people in other parts of the world experience their professional life, how much of this is the entitlement of the millennial and Gen Z generation moving into the workforce?
Yeah, it's really hard, and I've actually definitely seen a difference between the generations in my team. I had women that I hired that were 50, and I had women that I hired that were, you know, my age or younger. And I found that the women that were like in their 50s, it was almost like I had to put boundaries in for them, being like, stop working, go home, turn your phone off on the weekend, you know, stop doing after-hour visits with clients. They would be working so hard, whereas my other clients would be like, you know, I'm seeing a chiropractor at 3, so I have to go. And also I feel like, you know, I had to drive from Penrith today, then I had to go to Chatswood. I'm really exhausted and I need to prioritize my self-care, so I can't see my 4 o'clock appointment anymore. And then I'd be like, this is kind of the job and, you know, this is a child in need. We need to support. And they'd be like, well, what about me though? I don't have the energy. Like, how am I going to be there for this family if I'm exhausted? And then there's also, of course, people with families and they're like, I've got to do a kid's pickup and, or I've, you know, I've got to be here for this. And I'd be like, oh, shit, then I'd have to pick up on it. But now that I'm a mother, I'm like, I totally get that. So it's, I think it is, there's definitely a difference in, between the generations, but, and sometimes I would think millennials and younger would take it at times a little bit too far, prioritizing their comfort. But I also think that had these issues not arised, like I know that I was always, before I was a manager, I was the team spokesman for creating change in the workplace, where anytime there was an issue or we were all being crazy overworked, everyone would come to me and I would be the one to go speak to the bosses and speak up on behalf of the team. And even though they probably eye rolling, being like, God, they complain so much, shit got changed and things got more streamlined. Things became more effective. There were different processes put into place. There were things introduced like rostered days off, like once a month we got a day off, time in lieu, those kind of things. So
sometimes you need
a lot of benefits.
Yeah, you need a fighter. You need that person in politics who's fighting for the industry or the union. This is also very white collar. Both of our industries are generally, you know, your middle class in the Melbourne capital city type of industry. So, and look, I don't know a lot about the more blue collar industries. Like I said, it seems like even there, which you'd stereotypically think they're very radically honest and they just tell it like it is and pull people in line. And there's not as many safety regulations. That's certainly changing. There's a lot of OH&S that is continually coming in and probably, I'm assuming, mental health support and things like that. And, yeah, it sort of comes down to this greater societal trend of the inner world versus the external world. So we're prioritizing our comfort more so than our duty, for example, and historically, our duty would have been to the employer, to the nation, to the family, to whatever it may have been. And it's not as though we don't have any duties in our lives. You know, obviously you've got a huge duty to your baby there, but we are moving more towards a world where there's less focus on duty and more focus on, I wouldn't say comfort, but values alike, comfort and egalitarianism and mental, a positive social environment. And I wonder if on a societal level that might feel nice for us in the short term, but if we may bear the costs in the long term. So I guess hypothetically, you have you just duplicate Australia right now. One Australia goes more towards a duty-based thing where, you know, there's less, let's say right-wing governments tend to win, there's less regulations, really rich companies can just sort of manipulate their employers by just threatening legal action as they always do. This is the other thing that we should touch on where, you know, if the CEO and the boss of the company will always have definitely a financial power and legal power over any employee that feels wronged. And so that's in theory what unions are supposed to stand up for, but then unions also get quite corrupt and things like that. But coming back to this hypothetical, there's one country that goes more towards the duty side of things, and it instills this mantra of, you know, you got to work for the country. You got to, even if you are suffering, you keep pushing through and do the best for your family and be as diligent as you possibly can and be as disciplined as you possibly can. And I don't care how you're feeling, how sad you might be. It's just a sort of militaristic, authoritarian style of culture. And then the other Australia goes more towards a self-care, compassionate, egalitarian way of thinking where there's plenty of, there's mental health leave if you want it. There's these open but friendly and positive dialogues, and it goes towards a four-day work week, and it goes towards a just much more compassionate kind of society. I have no doubt that one in the short term would be, you know, country B would be better for everyone. It would be feel nicer. It would be comfortable. It would be friendlier. The issue is, okay, 20 years down the line, what do those two countries look like? If one has grown, let's say, at a rate of 4 to 5% GDP per year, whereas the other's grown at 2% GDP per year, well, then that one, over the course of 20, 30, 40 years, we're looking at a completely different country there. We're looking at, if they're still managing the taxation properly, we're looking at better infrastructure, better overall productivity. We're looking at just a greater ability to have resources, even if it is less of that tax base going back towards infrastructure and other public resources. There's just so much, there's an abundance of output that even that smaller percentage can go towards more. And so there's always a trade-off within an organization and then within the society at large about duty versus comfort, if you want to call it that. And I wonder what you think about something like that.
Yeah, look, to be honest, my understanding is that when self-care and comfort is prioritized, that there is actually a correlation to more effective work being done. Like the findings that came out of the four-day work week was that more productive work was being completed less hours. And I remember at one time in my office.
Can I jump in? You're absolutely correct. Those were two extreme examples, per se. But do you think there's a point to which it goes too far, I suppose?
Yeah, I don't know, because it's like of course there's a point where you can go too far. But there is you spend all your time in this workplace, and especially when you work in industries that can be really draining or tough, you want that to be prioritized. Like think about Google, and they have like snooze pods. They have a cafeteria of free food, or some places I know give like $1,500 a year to spend on wellness. People go buy themselves Apple Watches or use it for massages and things like that, which could be boost morale. And morale is everything in your workplace, I think.
That's true. Sorry, I just need to jump in really quickly with the Apple example. Those are the workers in America who are working at the top end of Apple, right? And they're able to profit off workers in China getting none of those benefits.
Okay, yeah, true. $2
a day.
Example.
So I suppose they're able to, do you think it's a luxury to be able to think about comfort and how it even relates to productivity? So long as there's an underclass in this like global, this is like the most left-wing thing I've ever said. This is like global capitalist environment where you're just extracting as much profit as you can from that underclass.
No, I don't think so, because we didn't have an underclass in my industry, and we had a Zen room with a massage chair. And we have roster days off every month. We got Time and Lou. We did workplace outings every week. I created a bonding day every three months. And I would the office would give me like $80 per person, and then I would just do random things like murder mysteries and stuff just to bond people and make them feel happy and stuff like that. So I'm the biggest advocate for that. I made the most change in my workplace because of this. And one day they decided that it's not appropriate to have decorated desks. And I had like salt lamps, crystals, photos, dream catchers, a foot massager, everything in my desk. That everyone would always come sit by my desk and be like, I love being here. And I had books, I had feeling cards, everything. And when they said, we want your desk swiped and everything cleaned, the petty millennial in me created a 12-page report with research that literally goes to show that people that can personalize their desks work more effectively.
And that's right. Yeah, I remember
all this
that.
Stuff, and it works. So I do think in some times that's good. But do you know what's an interesting example from white collar to blue collar is my fiance Adrian. He works as a landscaper, and recently a couple of weeks ago, something happened at his work. I won't go into it, but he was pissed off. And he came home, he was ranting about it, and he drafted this email and he was going to send it to the CEOs. And the email said, hi guys, literally, hi guys, I'm pissed off because you said this, it didn't happen, I'm not very happy about it, blah, 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 thanks, Adrian. And I was like, you can't send this. This is so emotional and so unprofessional. So I rewrote his email and I was like, dear so-and-so-and-so-and-so, I have invested many years into this and this, and I would like to see this organization make the same investment into me. So I'd love a plan to be put forward, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, his boss called him, and he was like, mate, you can't just demand all these things. So I was so, like, baffled by his email, and I was like, that's my bad. Maybe you should have just sent your email saying you're fucking pissed off.
I want to see that HR email. That's also hilarious.
Yeah, I felt so bad because he was like, I knew I shouldn't have done it. And I was like, trust me, babe, I know this stuff. You got to do it like this. And I thought it was such a good email as well.
With. Yeah.
I sent it to my friends. I was like, look at his email compared to mine. Like, how good is this? And they were like, oh, my God, 100 times better. Anyway, that blew up in both our faces. It was pretty funny for me, not for him. But, yeah, it's very, very different depending on where you work, who you're working with. And to be honest, I would also approach my male bosses differently than I would approach my female bosses, get things I want or, you know, try make change. I would never approach when I had a male CEO, I didn't go to him saying like, you know, it's really important that we prioritize the self-care, the team's really struggling, blah, blah, blah. I went to him and I said, if you want better results and you want more productivity in the team, here's exactly how it can be done. This step equals this, blah, blah, blah. Whereas in my female bosses, I could be like, look, everyone's feeling really drained and we need to do something. So it's, you got to kind of pick and choose and do different things, which is interesting.
And a strategy that could be effective for certain people could be perceived as manipulative or oppressive to others. So for some men in particular, just being, telling it to their face, being radically honest, being extremely disciplined and rough and just that sort of a person towards them can be effective. That can be what kicks them up the butt and pushes them in line. Whereas if you do that to another person, maybe a woman, then HR that is going to feel, that's going to feel very manipulative and aggressive. And so, like what I always say about these buzzwords, manipulation and toxic and narcissistic and gaslighting, they can be interpreted any which way. Like coming back to maths, oh, we got to do it. Harrison was like, you're gaslighting me. And then Bronte's like, no, you're gaslighting me. And I think most of people would be on her side there, but there are definitely situations where some person can feel like they're being the gaslighted when they're actually doing the gaslighting. And you just, I go into professional relationships thinking, okay, in times of stress and when in my industry tickets are low and the morale is low and all that sort of stuff, everyone is going to feel like they're doing the lion's share of the work. Everyone always feels like I'm doing much more than I should.
Yeah.
I do this and I don't get paid enough. Everyone thinks that. And so you have to already go in with that as the base level. No one's thinking, oh, yeah, I just cruise through and I don't do enough. Everyone has a narrative of at least I do the work that's required of me or I do more than what's required of me. So when you know that, you sort of then have to, well, maybe it does come back to massaging egos and trying to instill into other people that same mentality that everyone thinks that they're doing the most. So you've got to be aware that your ego might be telling you that you're doing so much and that you're overworked because you're working so hard, when it might be that you're just doing what's required of you. It might be that you're doing what is you might even be doing less than what's required. It's kind of like car crashes, isn't it? Every time I've heard someone who's gotten in a car crash, they'd be like, oh, this car just came out of nowhere. I've never heard someone say, yeah, it was my fault and I didn't do this. It's always, or at best, it's okay, I did do this, but there's never radical accountability in the car crash industry, is there? It's always, well, this guy came out of nowhere. Okay, no car comes out of nowhere. So someone is at fault in that situation, and it's often, you know, someone's more at fault, but the other person was also not really focusing, and it's probably a similar situation in most relationships where people have a mentality of, oh, I'm being manipulated or this is a toxic environment. Well, it could be that the boss is 80%, it's causing 80% of the toxicity, and then 20% of what they say to you in a radically honest way could be true, or it could be 80-20 the other way. It's very rarely 100-0 in those situations.
Yeah, it's so hard how subjective it is. It's a good example. Like, I get really frustrated when I see people say, you know, like their boyfriend told them, hey, you know, it hurts my feelings when you say this. And then she'll be like, you're being really manipulative, trying to pressure me to not express myself, or like something like that. And it's just, they genuinely believe this is controlling behavior because he's asked me to refrain from doing or saying ABC, or she has asked me. Like, it's just like, it is completely subjective. And some people will always instinctively put themselves as a victim position because it's an easier reality to accept and it's an easier narrative to say, especially with cars. Yeah, you're right. No one admits their fault except for me. I have openly admitted that I caused two crashes.
Two?
One to a Tesla and one to a Porsche. Oh, Eliza, both of which they let me off. Didn't even get my details except my car got fucked up both times. But and for stupid reasons. One, I kissed my boyfriend. I wasn't driving. I was at a stop sign and I got distracted and lifted my foot off the brake. So that was so stupid. And the second time I sneezed so hard, I don't know what happened. I sneezed. I didn't realize that we were stopping. And I went up the back of a Tesla.
I've got a car story for you. So you can tell me if it was my fault in this situation, right? So I'm going along Parramatta Road and I'm on the left lane. And so everyone's doing about 60, and there's this truck that has sort of edged out of a petrol station so that they're in the lane, and then all these other people are kind of going around them, and I didn't see that truck till the car in front of me had gone around it, and I was doing 60, and I'm like, oh, I could brake, I'll just go around it. And as I'm going around it, I go into the other lane a little bit. And there's another I didn't check my side mirror there. And there's another truck, and it actually wasn't an accident, but it was a near miss, and I'm lucky actually. And this one, the truck had to swerve a little bit around me, and then it parked in front of me, and the biggest and scariest looking man I've ever seen in my life gets out and starts mouthing off at me, you fucking this, fuck that, fucking dog, fuck. And I thought, okay, I should have probably just braked really hard in front of that truck that was edging out into the left lane. But at the same time, that truck, you can't, I don't know what the laws are for trucks, but you can't edge yet, be halfway out onto the highway.
It's that guy's fault. That pisses me off so much when people try to edge in.
Oh,
it puts everyone at danger.
Exactly.
Just wait till the coast is clear. That's shit in all ways.
Yeah, but that was a lucky miss. And then there was one where
out of your car, or did you, when he was yelling at you?
God, no. This guy was a monster. He was huge.
Did you respond, or did you put the windows up and just not make eye contact?
No, I just kept driving. I'm not going to talk to this guy. He's insane. So, I'm not going to talk. That kind of road rage, I'm not dealing with that. And luckily, no one scraped anyone or no one hit anything, so I didn't have to do anything. But that could have been bad. And then there was one where I actually did. Okay, I'll take accountability for this one. I had to merge three lanes on a highway, and then the highway's all curved. And then I merged the first two or three, and then I looked behind me and I checked my blind spot for those three. And then the last lane, I didn't. And there was a car there, and luckily I don't merge that abruptly, so I just sort of scraped me a bit. But well, be safe on the road, kids. So that one was my fault, and I'll cop that one.
That's my dog shaking under the table.
That's all good. The car still did come out of nowhere, though. It came out of nowhere.
Literally.
Came out. Yeah. In air.
Look at your blind spots. Yeah. Don't kiss your boyfriends whilst in the car.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, do all that. any final words on radical honesty and manipulative professional? I'm going to say one thing really quickly. In the arts industry, there's a lot of, well, in all industries, there's all these middlemen type people, like managers, and I'm sorry if there are any real estate agents listening, but people where you sort of think, okay, if you're getting a percentage, so when real estate agents were getting a percentage and the property market was going gangbusters, when they sold a $3, $4, $5, $6 million property in the Gold Coast and they're getting, some of them get, I think, some of the percentages were quite high. They're becoming millionaires.
Yeah.
And now I guess no one's doing anything manipulative there, but that's just me being frustrated at real estate agents like everyone is. Everyone in the construction industry, all right? Strata, don't get me started on these dogs.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But in entertainment, so many managers will just, in fact, I was talking to my friend Alex today, and one of the big management companies in Australia, they charge 30, they take 35% of your ticket sales just so you can be a part of their management, and you hardly get anything out of it, right? And so there's these kind of, and look, if you got to read contracts and things like that, but you look at even Kanye, who just cannot get out of this victim mindset, who thinks, oh, these Jews have manipulated me in the music industry. Bro, read the contract, and you're also a billionaire. It's very hard to feel sympathy for a man who's worth $2 billion looking at a bunch of people who are worth $10 billion thinking I'm oppressed. And there's a lot in entertainment. It is rife with these sharks that come in and they're like, I'll be a manager, I'll do this, I'll do your PR, I'll do whatever, insert this, which is not even hard to do. And they, okay, whether it's manipulative, that's subjective, but they smooze you. They're very charismatic. And like with any salesman, they're these Wolf of Wall Street types that just kind of, make you feel like you're, I gotta take this deal. And look, a lot of business is like that, let's be honest. But some people just blatantly lie and not even fulfill their contract. And then you think, well, it's maybe $5,000 to $10,000 and the legal costs are gonna be more than that. And so what's the point of even doing that? And they just get away with it. Yeah. And it's horrible. And these sort of, this is why, you know, institutions like Fair Work Australia and these sorts of things are, they're good. They're good for business. You can make a right-wing argument for the need for these organizations to exist. And that's the best way to, that is one where the government should do as much as it can to reasonably regulate predatory professional behavior. But there is a limit to that where there can be so many checks and balances that the business can't operate properly.
It kind of like comes straight back to what you were mentioning before and what we talked about in the previous podcast. It's like the grooming thing and young women going into porn or whatever at 19 but they were willingly doing it and they signed contracts and blah, blah, blah. It's kind of the same thing. And it's like, what's right? What's wrong? You're being manipulated. You're being trafficked, which, by the way, I'm not minimizing serious, serious issues. And it does obviously occur. But it's so, like, there's so many factors to it. Like, well, was this person vulnerable and were they abused or were they educated and interested in getting the porn industry and change their mind later on? Or was this person wanting to get a car and the car salesman gave them the pitch they wanted, or did the car salesman convince them strongly to get another car they didn't end up even wanting? It's such a complex, I guess, scenario. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I guess there's going to be manipulation is needed and sometimes as well. Like, it's anything, I guess, could be considered manipulative. Being nice and empathetic and prioritizing self-care could be seen manipulative in some ways as well as doing the opposite. So
it's adaptive because we're very social creatures, and the person who could the person who had the best attributes in order to lead the tribe and coalesce people around their vision, whatever that might have looked like in pre-language days, that person likely had some of what we would call dark tetrad traits, because they could make everyone feel like that everyone else is getting a better deal out of this social intercourse or this social situation, when really they know they're getting the best deal. And so it's adaptive, and that's why probably a lot of men have these kind of traits about them, and maybe why, like what we were talking about on the last podcast, maybe why some women still find it attractive on a subconscious level. So yeah, you can never avoid these sorts
of humans are so complex.
We are.
We're totally driven and towards or against our moral compass. Like, there's so, can I ask you a completely unrelated question, speaking of like ethics and things like that? I'm curious what you would say.
All right.
Okay, here, so if you had to I'll just wrap this up with this. If you had to choose between, this is dark, by the way, either Andrea in one room or 20 randoms in another room. Or we can make a 10, so it's a bit less extreme. 10 strangers in one room. And one of the rooms has to get bombed.
10.
Which one do you choose?
The 10 strangers.
Okay, but the 10 strangers are children. What do you choose now? Oh,
Jesus. Oh. Do I know the children?
Yeah, Remy's in the room.
Oh, God.
Just kidding.
Don't put me in that position. No, if I don't know the children and they're just random strangers, I think I'd go the children. I think I would.
Okay, because most people would say, I'll save the children.
Oh, really?
But then it's like, but what if those children were severely disabled and in an orphanage in China?
If I don't know them, no, sorry. Sorry, there's enough Chinese people that can get bombed.
Okay, let's not go. But, you know, like, it's, I guess the point is like your ethics like change and your moral with any kind of factors that get added into the mix. It's amazing what influences our decisions. Like, you'll never get it right, basically. And it's the same with working with people. You'll never get it perfect. You're either going to go too soft or too hard.
Now I've got to ask you a question like that. Would you sacrifice your life for I'm sure you'd sacrifice your life for your baby. Would you sacrifice your life for another baby?
Yeah. Actually, you know what? I saw this, a post on this on Reddit. I think it was actually on the Ask Men forum because it was specifically for men. Or maybe it was like Ask Reddit and it was like men. If you're in a burning house and there's your wife and children, whether or not they're your children or just random children, you can only save one. What do you save? And every single guy said, I will save the children because my wife would not forgive me if I saved her.
Really?
Every one of them.
I'm in the minority.
Thousands of them.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Ooh. They were like, she would never get over it. she'd just probably kill herself, some were saying. She'd be so mad, so depressed. I would save the children because I know that's what she'd want. And I asked Adrian, thinking there's no way he would 100% choose me. And he was like, I would save the children because I know that's what you'd want. And I was like, what?
Damn. So I'm in true. A, I would I'm, want I'm, that. I'm evil, am I? Okay. All right. Well. No, if it's a burning building, that's hard to not save the children in that situation. Yeah. But if from your situation it was like a random room that you've never met these
cognitive
children.
Cognitive dissonance.
Yeah, they're getting bombed.
Have you seen the movie, I think it's The Box or The Gift with Cameron Diaz?
No.
And basically it's like you can push a button and you get $1 million or $10 million, but someone in the world dies. I won't give anything more away because there's a huge plot twist and stuff, but that's the whole gist of the movie, that this guy goes around offering people that, and do they choose to do it knowing someone will die and take the money, or do they not do it?
That's way different. There's no two human lives. There's no comparison of human life there. I wouldn't take the money.
Well, it could be like, it could be like a 90-year-old person and could be, in the world.
No. No. Would you take the money?
Look who has morals after all.
Oh, yeah.
No, I wouldn't. I'll tell you the plot twist at the end of this. Actually, you should watch it. It's really good.
Okay.
I don't know if it's good, but I think it is.
Well.
Anyway, sorry.
There we go.
Sidetracked.
I'm a child murderer, so cut that out of context and get me cancelled.
He's pro-choice.
Yeah, look, we've got too many people on this planet, so I'm actually doing it for environmental reasons. So I'm a saint. Thank you for listening, guys. I hope you enjoyed that, and we sort of intertwined those two topics there, so hopefully it wasn't too messy for you. And if you like this podcast, please share it. That's the best way to grow a podcast, from sharing it, post it on Facebook, on your Instagram stories, anything like that. Really helps us out. And subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all the major platforms if you haven't already. Leave us a review if you like us. And also follow us on Instagram, TikTok, all of that. Come to a Comedy Untamed show. Subscribe to our YouTube @SexSellsPodcast. And we will see you next time. Bye, guys.
Next week.